Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, and I am Hillary Burns, and we have a very special guest today. This is a story like no other. His name, our guest is Stephen Quant. He is a cat behavior consultant, an author, a husband, a former theatrical lighting designer, a lover of cats and animals.
Yeah, come say hello.
I joke that no one can out-talk me about cats. I can just go. You and I could sit here all day if we had enough, you know, if we went into depth, and I don't think I'd run out of steam.
Yes!
I started volunteering with a cat rescue group and then ASPCA here in the city. And I didn't know it, but I was on a list of people who could be potentially called to go out on emergency deployments. On Memorial Day 2011, I got an email. We were having a party, a small party, and I just kind of looked at my computer the way, or your, you know, screen. Back then it was not, anyway. And I was like, whoa, can you get on an airplane tomorrow and come out to Joplin, Missouri, where there was this terrible earthquake, or sorry, tornado. And, you know, it was an EF5. And it destroyed the town. Hundreds of people were killed. So I went, and I worked in the cat shelter. We had cats and dogs, 1,200 ultimately. And at the end of that week, I was in charge of the cat shelter, and the population had grown from 100 to 425 cats. And my life changed in Joplin because I learned with one specific cat what it meant to relieve suffering in another creature. Something which is not generally taught below the professional level, ministers, doctors, therapists, things like that. And I helped this cat.
And I'm going to shut up before I give you the rest. He's going to give it to you himself. Welcome, Stephen. I almost
Thank you, Hillary. It is truly great to be here. Thank you so very much. If it's okay with you, I would love to give you just a quick headline as to kind of why I think we're here today. We may discover other reasons, but... I have discovered personally a new way to process trauma that I didn't know about until recently. And I want to share it with you as we go through this little journey. And hopefully it will be something that may be helpful to other people who have experienced trauma in their lives.
I'm sure it will be. All right. Now I can see you.
I love your glasses.
Yes, I'm sure it will be. I talk to a lot of people, and a lot of people have experienced trauma and don't know how to heal it, really. So thank you. So, all right. Ooh, so many questions. So I had never heard of a cat. Oh, wait, we got to show your book. Hold on. So this is Stephen's book. Hold on. It's called Happy Comes Home by Stephen Quant, and it's illustrated by
Indeed,
your husband,
it is.
Right? It's so beautiful, and the wait, I have stuff in here. It's just like, you know, it's so great. All the illustrations and everything, you feel like you're really, I felt like I had the cat and I was in there. It's just so lifelike and so great. I was like, how did he make this up? This is awesome. So anyway, you can talk about it now if you want, because I'm sure
briefly,
one
thing I want to mention is that great. All of the illustrations are done by hand. Tom is an artist and an illustrator, and there's no computer graphics. And I think that it feels like it was hand-drawn. You can see it. And the process of putting it together was so much fun. It was a joy. And you know, we took video of him illustrating it. And we had arguments. Sometimes I would see something that was missing, you know, it would reference a scratching post that wasn't there, or Mr. Top Cat's tail wasn't there. It's like, where's his tail? Yeah. And, you know, he'd go back in and put the tail in, and he'd be giving me a side-eye look, you know, like, but.
So did you come up with the story first and then he illustrated it?
Is the story it came up first. I kind of almost workshopped it with a couple friends of mine who are involved in my business and guide me and give me some counseling. And we kind of storyboarded it, and we wanted to basically give children a way of learning about and talking about cats in a way that is helpful to them and gives them the opportunity to be compassionate and help a cat who might be having trouble in a home acclimate and do well and really be the happy cat that they want to be. And basically that's the gist of it.
Now, I don't know if this is too personal, but are you a cat whisperer? Like, can you hear them speak?
Well,
and it's okay. So, I'm not going to laugh. I know there's bone, you know, there's,
I come from a scientific background to an extent. I'm not a scientist, but I'm certified in cat behavior. Okay. I studied it. And yes, the way cats, but cats talk to us through behavior, body language, vocalizations, they do things. And if we are open to that and we can read them, then yes, they absolutely talk to us. And sometimes they talk to us in ways that only their pet parent really understands. We can get very synced up with them in ways that are very connected. You know, people joke that, you know, dogs are, you know, very gregarious and very friendly, which they often are, and cats are aloof. Cats aren't aloof. Cats are quiet. Cats observe and react, but I'm deeply connected to my cats and to the cats that I work with professionally. It's a beautiful relationship that's subtle, oftentimes subtle. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. But yes, I feel like I'm a cat therapist, basically.
And what I just have to ask, since you said it, you got certified in cat behavior. What kind of place does that? I mean, this is all new to me. I'm not a cat person. I'm not barely a dog person, although my son has one, and I'm starting to love Maggie. She's this little thing, but it's taken something. So what kind of place does that? I never heard of that.
So imagine if you had a dog with a behavior problem and you went out and looked for a certified dog trainer.
Okay. So it's like a trainer.
It's like that, except dog training is more about manners training and social behaviors, walking on a leash, being good in a dog park, not being resource guarding. But there are also organizations that are very connected to the feline world, the cat world, and do training programs and education. There's outreach. So that's the kind of organization that I eventually went to. I got a lot of on-the-job training, years of working with cats, but I eventually decided I wanted a certification which produced, you know, more, it gave me more in terms of resources, and it's been helpful, very helpful.
Okay, question. How does someone become either, I know this is a weird question, but I just, it came to me, like, you're a cat guy. How does someone become a cat or a dog person? Do you think it's just instinctual what you like and reach out to?
That's a great question, Hillary. There are some people who aren't very animal connected, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's just who they are. Yeah, and that's fine. Other people are connected to animals, and I don't know if I know exactly why, but I think they gravitate. You know, some people gravitate towards cats, some people gravitate towards dogs, and other species as well. And it may have to do with personality and what type of feedback they want. What type of mirror they want to look at. What is the, you know, our animal is the mirror of who we think we are and what we care about. And some people like a really quiet but connected mirror, and other people want an effusive mirror. But it's a tricky question. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
So would you say the cat is like the quieter the quieter reflection. I mean, I know my son has this dog. She's adorable. But when we come in, she jumps up. She's so excited. Ah, that's a dog. A cat, what would a cat do when you come in?
A friend of mine, David Grimm, he's an author. He wrote a book, Citizen Canine, about the history of dogs and cats in this country. It's a great book. And he had a great analogy. He said that dogs listen to one radio frequency, us. Mm-hmm. And cats listen to many radio frequencies. Mm. They listen to us. They listen to the birds out the window. I mean, this is a generalization, right? Obviously, dogs can do this too. But cats have multiple interests. We're just one of them. And maybe in some respects, slightly secondary. But if you want an animal who's 100% focused on you, dogs are a good way to go.
Yeah. Interesting.
Mind you, I have a blind from birth girl. I have two cats. Jenny, my blind girl. She will tell me when she wants to sit on my lap because she will come up to me and cry and then lead me to the sofa. And if I don't lay down on the sofa so that she can get on top and lay on me, she will get upset. I mean, she won't do anything bad. She'll just be like, meow, meow, meow.
Yeah. Wow. And she's blind. Huh.
And she's blind and has incredible spatial memory and spatial mapping. She knows where everything is. She's gone into homes. She went into a house that we hadn't been in 6 years. And she knew exactly how to maneuver around the house. Within 5 minutes, she was up a vertical ladder to get to the loft bed that she liked. It's crazy. Wow.
Yes.
We have a lot to learn from these creatures.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. So back to you. Let's go back and start over again.
Sure.
I read the article. So do you want to tell people about what it was like growing up?
Yeah. I mean, if it's okay, maybe I should just start a little bit farther in the future.
Okay.
And then work back and we'll see how that goes.
Perfect. Yep.
As you know, I was a lighting designer for theater, which, you know, theater is about the human condition. And as a lighting designer, I'm kind of on the periphery. I'm connected to narrative and style and story and plot and character, but I'm a lighting designer. I'm not the actor. I'm not the director. So I'm in a kind of
I know I'm interrupting, but does someone learn how to do that? Is that instinctual or is there a lot of,
Well, a lot of practice and a 3-year Master of Fine Arts degree where I studied it 7 days a week for 3 years.
Wow.
And then continued to learn how to do it afterwards. It's, you know, I don't want to belabor it because we're on a different subject, but lighting design in theater is essentially painting 3-dimensionally in time. In other words, the painting changes every second. It's adjusting. And we're trying to create all sorts of things in our audiences, most of which they think of as atmosphere and mood, but we're also providing plausibility and a connection to the text.
Wow. Did you love it?
I did. And it was difficult and challenging and very satisfying. And then I started volunteering with a cat group.
Mm-hmm. And how did that come about?
Like, we adopted two cats. Oh, and okay. I walked into a Petco one day and said, hey, can I volunteer?
Okay.
And then I started volunteering with the ASPCA, a national organization based in New York City that does national advocacy and rescue work all over the country. And I got on a list of people that resulted in my getting a call on Memorial Day of 2011, asking if I could get on a plane the next day and fly out to Joplin, Missouri, the site of one of the worst tornadoes in modern American history. Hundreds of people were killed. The entire town was destroyed. And we set up a temporary emergency shelter for cats and dogs. And I showed up. I was a worker, you know, helping clean cat cages. We had about 100 cats at the time. 3 days later, I was in the number 2 position in the cat shelter. It's kind of like...
Because everyone left?
People are rotating in and out and they need to promote people. It's like a battlefield commission. When a officer gets shot and killed, they have to promote somebody, right? And then a few days later...
I know I'm asking.
It's okay.
When I have a question, I want... do you pay on your own? You pay for the flights and everything? And
They paid for everything.
Wow.
Very expensive. These operations are hugely expensive.
But it's run by the ASPCA, so obviously they have.
It was called the Field Investigation and Response Team. It's now called National Field Response. I went out as a volunteer. They also had paid responders, but I was a volunteer. And in any case, a week later, I was in charge of the cat shelter with 425 cats. And at the end, and during that time, this is where my life started to change, Hillary.
But you just took off from your life and just—
I was freelance lighting designer. I was between shows. I took off.
So it was
perfect. And I went out and I learned a lesson that I only learned relatively late in life, that something that isn't taught below the professional level. Mm-hmm. And that is what it means and what it is like to relieve suffering in another creature, human or animal. And I will tell you that if you've ever truly relieved suffering in another creature, it will change you forever. And it changed me. And it changed the course of my life and career. I didn't know it at the time, but that was the day when the road split. And I got a contract with them to be a responder, which meant that I would go out on these cases from time to time for a week or two at a time. And I would do theatrical lighting. I'd do a show. And then I'd go do a rescue case. It's a complicated life. And I did this for a whole bunch of years, mostly working on large-scale criminal cruelty cases. And I witnessed a lot of terrible things.
Now, okay. Can you go back to the first one where you relieved suffering and tell us what you did?
So this was not, as a story, it's maybe not dramatic, but it was dramatic to the cat. This was a cat who—
And you changed your life. Yeah.
We had dog crates, and every cat was in a dog crate, and they had a box that they could go into, to, like a cat cave, little hidey box. And she would not come out of that box ever during daylight hours. I never saw her come out. And what I would do is, in my moments when I had some free time, I would go to her crate and I would talk to her. I would give her a sweet voice to listen to, the same voice. This was important. I didn't know it at the time. And after a period of time, a number of days, all of a sudden, she poked her head out and she started to come out. This beautiful calico cat, who I immediately named Petunia. And she swam around in the kennel. She's doing these like really sweet motions and I'm petting her. And she hears another person coming and she was gone, back into the box. So then we started working with her more and having other people come by. And before too long, she came out for everybody. And in time, at the adoption event, there was an adoption event. We had 1,200 cats and dogs. And 6,000 people from 20 states showed up. And every dog and cat was adopted on Saturday. It was supposed to be a two-day event.
Wow.
And they, in fact, we ran out of animals. So we had to go to local shelters and pull dogs and cats for Sunday. But she got adopted. And if she hadn't gone through that process, she might not have been adopted.
Right. Now, what happened to the original owners? Or they could have died?
A lot of them were killed. And some, we also had owners reclaim as well. And it's very hard to explain what it feels like to relieve suffering in another creature. But I will tell you that it is like a bi-directional gift. We give them something and then they give something back to us. And the relief that they experience is like a gift of love that they give back to us. And we feel it in our souls. It's this moment where we're all, the both of us are together.
And what was the moment? Was it when she poked her head out or was it
basically, when she came out and
ultimately, you knew at that moment that
she was going to be okay.
Wow.
And
could you see her before that in the little cave?
Really. No.
So you just knew she was in there.
I just knew she was in there. A little fur.
You just knew to keep talking to her.
Yep. Keep talking.
Just her. What about all the other ones? There was something about her. There was something.
And she was the one I worked with. She was the one who, you know, a lot of the cats were doing fine.
Yeah.
In, you know, difficult conditions. But so that started the change in my life. And then I started to go and witness trauma because I was going out on dog fighting cases and puppy mills and large scale hoarding cases, hundreds of dogs, hundreds of cats in kind of fake shelters that were not treating animals correctly. And the way in which we dealt with it, the way in which I dealt with trauma, this is hard to witness. And there's something that you may have heard of, something called compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
It's not a good term. We don't like that term anymore because it implies that we're tired of being compassionate.
Right.
I'm not tired of being compassionate. What we're actually going through is what's called vicarious trauma. Mm. We are witnessing and shouldering other animals, other people's trauma, and it becomes traumatic to us.
Can I ask you a question? Why would people hoard so many animals? Was they just nuts? Do you know what I mean? Like, what would possibly be the reason?
So for some cases, they may be hoarding because they have a condition that's similar to people who hoard material goods. Mm-hmm. They don't see it. So or they see it, they don't recognize it. Or they think they're doing good. Or others are doing it for a malicious purpose, like making money. There are all sorts of awful reasons. And the way in which we would deal with this is, A, we would talk about it, right? That's one way of processing trauma.
Oh, okay.
We talk about it. We talk to each other about it.
After.
You can have organized conversation where you talk to a therapist or you talk to colleagues who understand. And then you hope that time heals wounds. And there was a case in New York City. It was actually the bird flu case, ironically, of years ago, where all the cats at the animal care centers of New York City were exposed to this bird flu. And the ASPCA created a temporary shelter where all the cats got moved to. And I was still working with ASPCA at the time. And I worked on that case. And one day I'm walking back to the subway with another responder who was not actually a responder. She was an administrator in the headquarters. And I forgot that she wasn't, quote, one of us.
Right.
This was new for her. And I confided in her a story about a thing that happened on a dog case, dog and cat case in North Carolina. And she burst into tears. And I felt terrible. I'm not supposed to process my own trauma by foisting it on other people, right? Mm-hmm. Innocents who aren't used to this. And I apologized. And I will tell you, I have never told that story since to this day to anyone. And so that's what I did for a long time.
What you did?
Working on these cases. And
so what did you do with the vicarious trauma of that if you didn't tell anyone?
Well, I didn't. I just lived with it. Mm-hmm. And then I took a job, a great job that I still have with the Animal Care Centers of New York City as a feline behavior specialist. Mm. And we were given the option of seeing a trauma therapist as a group. My team sees a trauma therapist every month or so, a small group of us who work in feline behavior. And one day a cat was brought to us, starving to death. Mm. This cat was left in a box next to a business. And this cat wasn't randomly left in a box. This cat was in a box that was branded with the name of the business that was where she was found. They put her in the box.
So no one would have known she was in there, right?
Well, this is often discovered. But yes, it's possible she would have simply died in the box. But someone found her and they called us and we picked her up. And the person from the field team who picked her up, I basically said, do you want me to come out to the truck and help you bring this cat in? And we bring this cat in and she is feeble beyond measure. She can't stand up. And we give her a can of food and she eats it, not greedily, not desperately, gently eats it, gratefully eats it. And we can't save her. She's too far gone and she had to be humanely euthanized. And I will tell you that hurt a lot. And I went to...
Because of the treatment?
Her condition. Well, I didn't know yet.
You didn't know yet. Okay.
I didn't. Other than the fact that it is. Yeah. No. It's okay. Other than the fact that it's painful to witness this and it hurts, and none of us, suffering is just painful, right? Mm. But I didn't know exactly what was going on in my own head, and so I went back to our therapist and I started talking to her. Ultimately, this led to me being introspective about all of this and writing about it for a long time to really figure it out. But one of the things that we talked about and that I came to understand was that as a child, as a gay teenager in the 70s, I had no future in the sense that I had no imagination as to what I could have. Because the way in which we understand our futures in terms of life and love and having family, we see it. We see it in advertisements. We see it in movies and TV shows. And it's represented to us. Our family mirrors it to us.
Right.
And I didn't see any of that. It wasn't represented. In the 70s, gay people were considered clowns at best.
So you knew you were gay, but you hadn't told anyone.
Correct.
Right. So you're hiding this secret inside, wondering what the heck is going to happen to your life.
Right. And with no thought as to what might come next or be good in my life. I had no thoughts of boyfriends, certainly not of marriage. That wasn't even remotely a thing. Right. But not even relationships, no picket fence, no house with a white picket fence. Obviously no kids, none of it. There was nothing. It was a gray amorphous blob. And what I that later
been terrifying. Oh, were you scared or just like, what was the feeling?
On the one hand, I was scared of being found out and being deserted by all my friends. And on the other hand, I was living a solitary life with nothing to look forward to. And so by talking about all of this, what I discovered is that in working with animals, in my case cats, but it doesn't have to be cats, right? I was trying to find futures for all of these cats that have no future.
So when you couldn't find it for the one who died, that was it.
Right.
You failed.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
And precisely, I failed. And when I fail at finding a future for one of these beautiful creatures, the way in which I understand this is that it just hits me again that I was someone who had no future, and I failed us both. In a sense. Mm. And with that understanding, we start talking about it as a group. And what I discover is that I'm not alone. My team, we've all had types of trauma in our childhood, different types, but connected to family, and that we all gravitated towards animal welfare. And this is helpful. Very helpful. The insight is helpful. But even without the insight, what I discovered is that I'm essentially, and this is where I come to this new way of processing trauma. Mm-hmm. And I realize I'm getting to, an important part of the story, maybe before we're done talking, but it's okay. We're getting there in an organic way.
When we're supposed to, yeah.
Exactly. What I learned is that besides talking about trauma and besides allowing the gift of time to mitigate the trauma, if you can channel it in a positive way for other creatures, people or animals, you're not only helping them, but you're also helping yourself. Because you are giving it's like the relieving suffering. You are giving a gift that is given back to you. And that's how my life changed, I think everybody has to come to their own idea of how they might channel their own trauma.
So let's say you, I don't know if you relieved the cat who died before she died. Let's say you did by feeding her. I don't know. Or another one, or Petunia. Let's say you relieved that cat's trauma. Does that in turn release your own? Is that what you're saying? Or are you just saying that you're relieving theirs?
Both. It's paying me back for what I lost. Hmm. It is allowing me to feel like I succeeded for someone else. Mm-hmm. And that reinforces my feelings of myself, where I felt my own loss or lacking, or, you know, it's a positive. It's a good thing.
Yeah. Now, I have a crazy thing, and you don't have to play this game, but no, I mean, I had a story when I grew up, and it was not tragic, but in my mind, it was poor me, whatever, victim, you know. It was just a story that they didn't understand me. I didn't fit in. I mean, I came from a great family. Really, there was no, I didn't have a real trauma just in my story. Okay.
Good.
Now I can go back and rewrite the story instead of poor me. I didn't fit in, whatever. I don't even know what I would write. I could. I haven't. I'm not saying I've done it, but I could, so that I don't have that victim, you know, because that was me. I was a confused victim. I did some transformational stuff and I saw that's what I was. And then I had a choice not to be. Now, I'm not saying that you need to do any of this, but knowing your life now, and I'm just curious, and you don't have to do it, could you go back and rewrite the story? It wasn't your experience. Your experience was you had no future. But could you rewrite it? I don't know. I'm just curious.
No, it's an interesting question. No one has asked me that question before. And I think the answer is yes, because even if it's not technically true, there is a truth to it. I can write the aspirational version of my childhood, knowing where I am now, and say, okay, Stephen, let's rewrite it. It doesn't mean I give myself a boyfriend and all those things, but I can say to myself, you're going to get those things.
Yeah.
And in fact, the truth is I did.
Yeah.
I've been together with my husband for 32 years.
Wow.
Married for, you know, about a third of that. And we have a great life together.
Do you have the picket fence?
We're in an apartment in New York City.
You're in New York City, yeah, okay.
But the proverbial picket fence.
Yeah.
And we've got good friends, and we have our animals, our cats. Yeah. And it's lovely. And what I balance is always being aware that there is another, because I work with cats, right? Mm. And part of that work is in the city shelter, which works so hard on behalf of the city. I can touch on that if you'd like to. But okay. I'm always cognizant of a cat who's in a kennel waiting for something good to happen. Mm. And I'm always working to make that happen for that cat and the people who are looking also to have their lives changed. Mm.
It's almost like with children in an orphanage. Do you know what I mean? But these are cats, right? Look, think about them too, waiting for their forever home.
But there, you know, there are lots of great stories. I was on an adoption event recently. We had the truck. It's out. And the line was down the block, and we had a bunch of cats, and I'm assisting with adoptions. And we finish, and I go back to the shelter. And then I see this couple. And I come up to them, and they're like, hey, we were at the event. But we ran out of time. We were like the last ones, and we didn't get on the truck.
Oh.
And I said to them, well, guess what? There was one cat, a super sweet cat, who was not adopted. And she's downstairs right now. Would you like to go meet her?
Oh.
And they said yes. And I took them down, and this cat was just loving. You know, she was like a dog. She's like rubbing.
She just happened to be left.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's like her ship came in. they said yes. And they took her home. And, you know, so I have lots of stories like that that are heartwarming and affirming and give me reason to.
All right. We're going to continue. Write that down so we don't forget where we were. We're going to go quickly to our commercial break, and then we'll be right back with more of the story. All right. Be right back.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of 3 books and has a program called the Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real Process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. It's a social emotional learning platform that you could bring into your schools to help your children connect, play, and just get more belonging in their lives. And it's been, kids love it. Teachers love it. It's better than recess, they say, as the commercial said, but also, you know, behavioral issues go down and kids start being able to learn. So check it out, KikoriApp.com. It really is a gift to our children. And then as always, my books, the one my mother thinks is a terrible name, Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. This is about when I had my two sides of life. One was the dark side and one was the fun side. Techniques for how to spend less time on the dark side. So it's my own little version of creating freedom for people because it worked for me and I would forget them. So I decided to write the techniques down. They still work. This one, Real Talk, is about saying the things you're afraid to say to have the life you've always wanted. If you have trouble with that, I certainly did, please reach out. You can go to realtalkwithhillary.com, special website for that. And then my original book, The Second Piece of French Toast. This is my story. And, you know, again, I was in a dark place. That's where I learned the stuff from the other 2 books. You can find them all on Amazon. And if you want an inspiring and courageous story, it was, I was a little afraid to put that out there, but I did. And now it's out for people to read. So welcome back to the studio, Stephen. This is such a great story. I just love it. And I know
The website that you were referring to during the break for children, can you link me to that? I'm very curious about it. I'd love to know more about
absolutely. It. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I will do that. I'll write it, make a note. Yeah. It's KikoriApp.com, and I'll just spell it for you. K-I-K-O. But I'll give it to you later, so don't worry about writing it down. K-I-K-O-R-I, and then APP.com. And it's just... It's a great, great
platform. I'm really, really curious about it.
Okay, good. Yeah, we can talk about it when we're done. Yeah, cool. Thank you. All right. So where were you?
Where was I? I don't know.
Well, you had said you've been together for 32 years, but it was, the story about that couple who couldn't get in the truck and you gave them the cat. Yeah.
So, you know, there are lots of heartwarming stories about that that are affirming and remind me as to why I do what I do. It's the balance to the trauma, which is, you know, because of the work that I do, it's just part of the gig, you know.
Now, what do you mean by that? The balance to your own trauma?
Well, I mean, what I mean is that with good adoption stories, there are also sad things that happen, like the cat that came in. Right. Yeah. And so one helps balance the other. We couldn't do it if it was all trauma.
Now, would you say that your childhood trauma has been healed through this work or just in the therapy and stuff? Like, do you, and I don't know how you know, or maybe it disappears. I think it disappears when it's healed, but would you say?
Yeah, I think in large measure, yes. I think I just, it's always there. There's potential to re-experience it. And I'm like in this strange,
like what? I can feel the sadness now, like sadness for that little boy.
Yeah. And I am in a, it just so happens that the work that I do is both life affirming and also involves vicarious trauma. So it's like the yin and the yang. To get the one, I have to put up with the other.
Right.
I have to tell you, there is an organization in Chicago that provides essentially foster homes for cats when the cat parent has to go into a hospital or a rehab facility. And it's run by a former nun, Sister Mary John. And she explained to me her own personal trauma as a child, where she was told she was going on a little trip and her mother delivered her to an orphanage and gave her up.
Oh my God.
And as we talk about this, it all becomes clear to me that this is just yet another example of someone who moved into animal welfare in a way that was connected to earlier life trauma.
What happened to her?
She spent a number of years in this orphanage while her mother was, I guess, recovering from an illness and eventually came back home, but was always threatened with, if you don't behave, you're going to go back to the orphanage.
Oh,
it was literally a threat.
Oh, terror.
And it's terror. But it's obvious to me that that ultimately led to the work that she does, taking care of those who are not taken care of.
And she's at the foster home for cats.
She has a foster home for cats.
Yeah. Oh, she created it.
Yes, she did. It's been running for over 30 years.
Isn't that amazing?
Right. It's totally amazing.
Wow.
I'm going to be visiting this shelter in this foster situation in May and giving a talk for them. But it's just striking to me our connection to all of this. And so, again, I'm not a professional therapist. You know, I'm a cat shrink, essentially.
Cat shrink.
But to the extent that you can even understand the trauma that you've been through, sometimes we kind of compartmentalize it and we try not to think about it, and can channel it. That's what I'm advocating for, is how can we channel our trauma in ways that produces good results for others and, again, mirrors back to ourselves. I feel blessed by the work that I do, ultimately, on balance. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Well, I think our young incidents or, you know, events do impact where we end up. Do you know, like mine, I always felt I was negative. I wasn't allowed to be upset. You know, I had to be this pretend phony person because I was supposed to be good or something. And that's what Getting Real came from. And that's why when I finally said, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to change my negativity, but I can use it to help others who feel the same. Like, it's not wrong. once I can allow it, I can actually be happy. But when I think, oh my God, I'm upset and I'm not supposed to be, you know what I mean? So I think we all end up in some way based on what happened. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just, it's so obvious, you know, coming into this conversation with you and, you know, and we've met prior to kind of discuss what we might be discussing, yeah. Right? But none of this became obvious to me until really right now. Mm. You are in the exact same spot. You have figured out how to process your own trauma by talking to other people, helping them and helping them express.
Right. By listening to your story.
You and I and my colleagues and the sister, we're all in the same boat and we're all doing the work and giving the gift and getting the gift back.
Right. Well, if you think of like nurses, if you think of caretakers, if you think of, you know, EMT, like I'm sure they all had something that led them to what they're doing. Yeah.
So the helping professions.
Yeah. It's sort of like what you didn't get, you're now giving in a sense.
Yep. One of my colleagues has a mom who wasn't really emotionally available to him. Another one of my colleagues had a dad who was addicted to drugs and she couldn't help him.
Mm.
Right. So what do? We help.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting.
You're deeply in the club.
Well, I guess it's good, right?
It is. Yeah. It's totally good.
Yeah. Wow. Woof. All right. So what else? Chernobyl. You didn't talk about Chernobyl. You want to talk about that? Or is there something else you want to go? We have about 7 minutes before we need to wrap up. What do you?
Yeah. So I'll mention it as, you know, it's connected to all of this. During Hurricane Sandy, I worked on that. We had a case in New York City with displaced cats and dogs. And I met a veterinarian, a visiting veterinarian named Dr. Jennifer Betts. And it was a very difficult working situation. It was very loud. It was stressful, just physically stressful. And I basically insulted her our first day. And our second day, she came in and said, "Are you going to, you know, chew my ass off again?" And I'm basically a medical administrator. That was my job at the time. And she was a vet. And we both burst out laughing and became good friends. And she later became the medical director of the Dogs of Chernobyl Project, which is a project to spay, neuter, provide medical care and research on the dogs that descended from the pet dogs that were left behind after the nuclear accident in 1986. And I told her, I said, you know, I would love to.
Generation.
Sorry?
This was the next generation after
generation after generation after generation. I mean, the dogs typically don't live longer than 4 or 5 years of age. It's a very tough environment. So many generations of dogs later, she starts doing work to stop the breeding, let the dogs live out their lives. And I said, I'd love to go. And she said, okay. And then I got full-time employment at animal care centers. And when I started the job, I was scheduled to go to Chernobyl that spring. And I said to my boss at the time, I could never make this a condition of employment, right? Yeah. But I said, is there any way you could let me go for a few weeks while I'm on probation?
Right.
And go to Chernobyl. And she talked to leadership and leadership said, yes, but we'd like you to give a presentation when you get back. So I took photos and videos and I put together a whole thing. And it's a webinar that I still give to this day. Because after giving it at work, I discovered then the pandemic hit and Zoom became a big thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so I give webinars on cat behavior and Chernobyl. And I went there and worked with these dogs. I mean, I did my job, my bit. There are many people and many different roles to fill. But we basically provided care and have gotten it to the point where the population isn't growing anymore. Which is a good thing because we want to limit the amount of suffering and let these dogs.
Because they were radiated, is that why?
No, it's just they're wolves. They're raided upon. The winters are tough, but they're fed. They're now their feeding stations. They get medical care. There's a team and process their research papers, 34, at least 34 dogs came back to the US and Canada. And the adopters of these dogs, each one to a person, to a dog, donated a blood sample to the National Institutes of Health for genome sequencing, DNA sequencing, and long-term study of these dogs. And I met my, I tell this story, my last day.
What was it about these dogs? Was it that they were, I don't know if you call it feral, that they were living in the woods, or that they were radiated, or that, like, what was it about them that is so interesting? I mean, I hear Chernobyl, I think, radioactive, but what is it that makes them so interesting?
Well, deserving of care. You know, it's the only large closed population of dogs in the wild in the world.
Oh.
And no one was helping them. And they were just living and breeding and dying, and no one, other than the workers at the nuclear power plant feeding them scraps, no one was doing anything. So this was...
And their people just disappeared. Like, where did they come from?
Well, so there was a town called Pripyat. Okay. That's the town where the workers lived, and they would travel about 4 miles every day to go to the plant.
Okay.
And when Unit 4 exploded, everyone in the town waited for 2.5 days to be told what to do. 2.5 days with the equivalent of 400 Hiroshima-sized nuclear bombs scattering radiation all over Europe, actually.
Oh, God.
And then they were told they had to pack their bags and leave. They were given less than an hour, and they were told they had to leave the dogs behind, that they'd be able to come back for them.
Okay.
And instead, the military came in and tried to kill the dogs, but they didn't. Many of them lived. And the town was abandoned.
Yeah, wow.
No one lives in that town. I've been there. It is concrete edifices and an amusement park that is all being reclaimed by the soil and by trees. Wow. It's extremely eerie. And so they left, and the dogs stayed behind.
Okay.
And the dogs basically relocated around the plant because that's where the food was coming from. And so this organization, the Clean Futures Fund, it's cleanfuturesfund.org. If you Google the dogs of Chernobyl, you'll see the work that's being done. They decided it was, by the way, can we plug my website before we finish?
Absolutely. And it'll be under your name in the.
Okay.
Yeah.
This organization.
Go ahead and say it so we don't forget.
Catbehaviorhelp.com. Okay.
Cat
behavior. A lot of resources there. Catbehaviorhelp.com.
And we're going to wrap up in like a minute. So,
okay. So in any case, the bottom line is that these dogs were not cared for, and now they are cared for, and they are studied, and they're given assistance. And it is a humanitarian project on behalf of animals who otherwise were not getting any help.
Hmm. Thank you. And if you go to his website, you can see the story about that. Unless you want to tell it real quick.
Well, we've told some of it, but I think I'm not sure we have enough time to tell too much more.
All right. So we'll keep you in suspense. Go to his website and they can find it, right?
Yes. If you want to hear a 3-minute story about it, StoryCorps, if you say StoryCorps Dogs of Chernobyl, there'll be a 3-minute interview with me talking about it and all of this, really.
Yeah.
You know, our ways of becoming humane, of being humane and helping each other and helping ourselves.
Mm. Oh, all right. So in wrapping up, we do have a couple minutes. What is your vision for the world? If you had your way, what would the world look like?
It would be a kinder place where we make real connections, including with people who aren't necessarily a part of our daily life.
Mm.
It's very easy to be connected to people who mean something to you, and I'm not denigrating that at all. It's super important, family, friends. But if you can help a stranger, strange animal, strange person, someone in need, if you can give that gift that I experienced with Petunia in Joplin, your life may be changed, And there are ways to pursue this. It might be a hobby, an avocation, something you try and do outside of your daily working life. But I know, speaking personally, that if you can relieve suffering in another sentient being, your life will probably be changed as well. And if all of us do that, even just once, it's going to be a lot of good feeling out there. Happier
great.
People, better world.
Yeah. And did you ever think that from being a theatrical lighting designer, you would end up being a cat behavioral person?
Like, not a chance.
Not a chance.
Not a chance. And, you know, that's being open to things that come your way in life and realizing that at different stages in life, we have different opportunities. Helping others helps ourselves.
Right. There is that, you get it back.
In spades.
Yeah.
So much more than you could possibly imagine.
Yeah. More than you even gave. You get it back, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to go back to Joplin to adopt Petunia if she didn't get a home.
Oh.
We weren't allowed to adopt during the operation, during the work that we were doing, but we were always allowed to come back. And I was going to come back. I was going to fly back and get that cat, but she got a home.
Oh. And did you already have cats when you went?
I did.
You did. Okay.
It would have been an issue. And my husband and I have this rule. I don't bring work home. And you know, the first cat that I fell in love with at animal care centers was this orange cat named Yellowstone. And he was sick and he was scared and yet very affectionate. And I would meet with him every day. We became friends. And one day he went to the medical department. He had an x-ray. He came back terrified. He was like a just frozen. And you couldn't even see the color of his eyes. He was so scared. And I went up to him. And I spoke sweetly. And I'm thinking to myself, I can't bring him home. But I said, if he was going to be euthanized, if there was any reason why he would be euthanized, I'd just bring him home unannounced. And I, you know, my husband, Tom, could yell at me if he wanted. And I went up to him and I spoke sweetly and I gave him my hand and he sniffed it and he leaned in like I had come to save him. And it was at that moment I knew I would break the rule if he was going to be euthanized. I would bring him home. And I told the story to Tom that night when I got home. And he looked at me and he said, of course you'd bring him home.
Oh.
And Yellowstone, you know, he recovered, he got healthy, he got adopted. Oh. I have photos of him in his new home and I didn't have to break the rule.
Oh, that's beautiful. All right. Well, thank you so much, Stephen. It was so great to have you. So inspirational. And I appreciate the work you're doing. So
Thank you, Hillary, for having me. It's great to make this connection with you. We share more than we knew going in.
Yes, exactly. All right. Thank you so much. All right, guys. See you next week.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started Getting Real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.